It is Monday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, U.S. Republican presidential contender Donald Trump appears to defy his critics once again. We'll ask what's next for a U.S. journalist jailed in Iran as he awaits an imminent verdict in his case. We'll also find out how investigators are examining plane debris linked to missing flight MH370. And we'll look at a new Broadway musical about the life of America's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, U.S. tycoon and Republican presidential contender Donald Trump appears to be surviving the latest backlash to an election campaign marked by sharp personal attacks on his critics. A Reuters Ipsos poll released on Monday suggests he has the backing of 24% of Republican voters. That's more than double his nearest rival, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who was at 12%. The poll was conducted after last Thursday's Republican presidential debate that sparked a feud between Trump and a female television anchor, Megyn Kelly, one of the debate moderators. After the debate, Trump made comments about Kelly that many Americans perceived to be sexist, although he later denied that he had any such intention. I spoke today with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone and asked him how Trump's Republican rivals have been responding to his remarks about Kelly.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Remember, we have a total of 17 Republican contenders at the moment. A few have stood up and criticized Donald Trump in the wake of some of his comments about women, different things. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, former CEO Carly Fiorina has also been critical of Trump and his comments about women. But some of the other candidates have been deciding to sort of take a pass on it. They may not think the comments were particularly nice, but they're not going to be directly critical. I'm thinking of people like Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Ohio Governor John Kasich, for example, said in the debate that Trump has tapped into something in the country, an anger and frustration, something he understands that's going on. So it's a real mixed bag right now. I think this goes to the idea that a lot of the rivals of Trump don't really know how to approach him right now. They don't know how to handle him. They're going to be watching the polls very closely as well. Let's be honest, too. Some of them would love to have that support he has right now. So they want to be careful what they say about him so that they don't hurt their chances of winning over those voters down the line should Trump sort of self-destruct.
Well, what opportunities do the Republicans have in the coming days and weeks to try to get their messages out to more voters?
This debate got a huge audience, 24 million, largest primary debate of all time, really, in terms of television ratings. So, yes, they tuned in for Trump, but they got to see other people like John Kasich, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, earlier Carly Fiorina. So in a way, Trump's presence there caused a lot of interest, but is an opportunity for some of his rivals to get noticed. The next debate is going to be in mid-September. The Republicans have fewer debates this time because they felt in 2012 there were too many and their candidates got caught up and, you know, were not able to build on public support. There will be some smaller events in between, but certainly what we're starting to sense is these debates are going to be a huge defining moment in the campaign, as this last one was. So a lot of them are already going to be planning for the next debate in mid-September in California.
Is there any intensification of the election rivalry on the Democratic side? They don't have a debate for a while until October, I think. But, for example, Joe Biden, there's been a lot of talk of him possibly getting in. What do we know about that?
Well, we just know that I just got an email in the inbox from the Draft Biden Group, which is supposedly not operating with his, you know, sort of say-so or permission, but they're adding staff people. They're trying to gear up. So the effort to try to convince Joe Biden to get in the race is intensifying, if anything. But we're hearing nothing from him that suggests that he's made a decision one way or the other that could come in the next several weeks, perhaps, and we hope to hear something. But Bernie Sanders continues to draw large crowds. though a very interesting thing happened in Seattle where some black activists took over the stage at a downtown rally and kind of forced him to close out the rally. So the whole Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, what's going to happen on the Democratic side? She's looking a little vulnerable right now. Democrats are getting excited about making a challenge, but the question still remains, can any of the Democratic challengers really beat her?
For now, it doesn't seem that way, but we'll see which way the polls go. Well, thank you to our national correspondent, Jim Malone.
My pleasure.
Well, it's time now to check what's trending on social media. For today's segment, International Edition's Giabi Lee takes a look at how the Republican presidential contenders have been doing since last week's debate. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. As you mentioned earlier, the latest poll shows that Donald Trump is still leading the Republican presidential race. CNBC Now tweeted earlier Monday that Donald Trump maintains support of 24% of Republican voters in new online Reuters Ipsos poll with 6.7% margin of error. Bush trails with 12%. That's been shared more than 750 times within the last 3 hours. And of course, Trump himself retweeted that.
Well, that's not really surprising, is it? He likes to tweet those kinds of positive stories.
Absolutely.
And that's quite a significant gap, isn't it, between Trump and Bush?
It is. Jeb Bush is one of the perceived losers from Thursday's debate, which might explain why he hasn't tweeted about the event. His Twitter handle is @JebBush.
Okay, well, besides Trump, who else is considered to have benefited from the debate last week?
Definitely Carly Fiorina. She's a former CEO of Hewlett-Packard and on Twitter @CarlyFiorina, that's F-I-O-R-I-N-A. A day after the event, she tweeted @GOPDebate, I won over our largest audience yet. Another contender who was happy with how the debate went was Ben Carson, a retired neurosurgeon. Megyn Kelly with Fox News, who moderated the debate, tweeted Carson was very pleased with his performance during the debate. He's on Twitter @RealBenCarson. Michael?
I'm sure Carson was happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that analysis, G. That was Giabi Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter @GiabiLee. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The disappearance of forests leads to erosion, soil degradation, and other environmental problems. But much of what has been lost may be regained simply by planting trees. John Leary is the executive director of Trees for the Future.
Planting trees is a real critical anchor in the community, and it's kind of a real essential thing to return tree cover to the degraded lands.
Leary says they have planted more than 100 million trees since their inception about 25 years ago, and they are especially focused on sub-Saharan Africa.
And we guide farmers through the process of planting fast-growing and thorny trees that help revitalize and stabilize fields.
Last year, Trees for the Future put more than 20 million trees into the ground.
Really trying to help 4,000 families plant their way out of poverty.
The plan, says Leary, is to grow the program to reach 10,000 families in the next few years. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. A lawyer for Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian says Iran could issue a verdict in his espionage trial within a week. The lawyer was speaking after a Tehran court issued, or held rather, a final closed-door hearing in Rezaian's case on Monday. Stephen Schneebaum is a Washington-based international legal expert who has been following Rezaian's case. My colleague Jeffrey Young asked him whether he thinks Rezaian's trial met international standards for fairness.
No, I think it quite clearly does not. In fact, I think it would be difficult to make any argument to the contrary. It doesn't pass the fairness test because it was conducted in secret, because his attorneys were denied the opportunity to meet with him and to make meaningful submissions to the court. It's not at all clear that the judges on this court are properly legally trained in order to render a verdict in accordance with the law. There are many, many defects in this trial.
What I understand, if you can explain this for people, dual citizenship does not always mean that your American or whatever passport is going to come to your rescue. Obviously, in Mr. Rezaian's case, this did not happen. And why?
Well, dual citizenship rarely comes to the rescue of individuals who are accused of violating the criminal law. I mean, imagine, for example, someone picked up in this country for any number of different kinds of offenses. That person would be put on trial, irrespective of whether he or she happens also to hold a British passport or a German one or an Australian one. All that dual citizenship does is it allows the other country of nationality to espouse the case of the defendant, of the accused, and to raise diplomatic protests and to assert the rights of its citizen. But within the domestic legal system, citizenship is not a, I hate to use this term this week, it's not a trump card.
I understand that last month the Washington Post newspaper filed a petition with the United Nations Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions, trying to see if they can pressure Iran to release Jason Rezaian. Do they have any real tools to extract him?
I don't think they have any real tools to extract him, sadly, but they do speak to a very broad and wide audience around the world, and they speak for the international community. Now, this is a time when Iran appears to be making some efforts to behave, for the first time in many years, like a respectable sovereign nation. So this may be a time when the kind of pressure that the United Nations Human Rights Council can bring to bear would produce a greater reaction within the Islamic Republic than might have happened before the nuclear negotiations began, and certainly before they came to fruition. But it's hard to predict that.
That was Stephen Schneebaum, an American international law attorney, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Well, turning to business news, Chinese stocks had a great start to the week, posting their biggest rally in a month on Monday. I spoke earlier with our business correspondent Alexis Christophers in our New York bureau and asked her what's behind the Chinese market rally.
Well, Michael, we had data over the weekend that showed producer prices in China fell last month to a six-year low. Exports dropped more than expected, but that wasn't enough to get the markets down. It looks like traders are betting the Chinese government will accelerate mergers of state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, to help boost economic growth. We saw the Shanghai Composite Index jump nearly 5% to 3928, led by industrial, energy, and telecom companies. China Shipbuilding, China Coal Energy, and China United Network Communications all surged by their 10% daily limit. And there are reports that China is considering combining its two major shipping companies, China Shipping Group and Costco Group. So that anticipation of more reform among the SOEs in China is really helping to boost the stock market, at least in the short term.
And looking at the price of oil, it is still really low. What's keeping it down?
Well, we did see a nice pop in crude oil in the most recent session. It was up about 2%, approaching $45 a barrel. However, there is still more downside pressure. And one well-known oil analyst, John Kilduff, believes that oil will probably bottom out in the low 30s by September or October. Saudi Arabia continues to produce a lot of oil, hurting non-OPEC producers. And at some point, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips will be buys. But for right now, analyst Kilduff says he's standing on the sidelines because he thinks there's more downside pressure for oil overall.
Alexis Christophers in New York, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Do you like to sleep on your back or on your stomach? If so, you may want to think about some new findings from researchers at Stony Brook University in New York. The researchers discovered that sleeping on your side might help your body remove potentially harmful leftover chemical components from your brain, components that are implicated in neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The researchers studied MRI images of the glymphatic pathway, which is a complex system for clearing waste, in the brains of sedated rodents as they slept on their back, front, and side positions. The researchers found that waste transport was most efficient when the rodent slept on its side, and say that further MRI imaging research with humans is necessary. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Aviation experts in France have been examining a piece of plane debris linked to last year's disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. VOA correspondent Carolyn Persutti recently visited a U.S. laboratory that also investigates plane crashes. Earlier, I asked Carolyn what she learned from her visit about how the debris analysis is being conducted in France.
They are probably using various techniques of, first of all, looking at the material device, the actual part, the debris, and investigating it that way, taking measurements, swabbing it, looking at numbers on it, looking at the way it detached itself from the plane. Then they'll look at it under various microscopes for more evidence.
And I understand you've actually spoken to people not far from Washington who are doing that kind of work. Can you tell us more about that?
That's right, Michael. In Stevenson, Maryland, which is on the eastern shore of Maryland, a group called the RTI Group does this on a regular basis. In fact, they've investigated many other plane crashes, including Air France 447. And as you know, that took 2 years to determine where the plane was and what caused that crash.
What can experts learn from the condition of a plane part that they're analyzing?
Because this plane part is still basically intact and in very good shape, Joe Reynolds from RTI Group says he thinks that meant not a direct crash nose first into the ocean. So what he thinks is the plane came straight down flat to the ocean, parallel, if you will, as much as it could, as a plane can. That's what he thinks. But of course, we'll wait for the experts on that.
There's also the matter of how a part detaches from a plane. What can the analysis tell you about the way that the part detaches?
Very important. They look at various things on the plane part that they're investigating. Where that detached, first of all, they'll look at the force of detachment to give them some inkling on what caused it. They'll look at the force to see the plane part that was supposed to be next to it. So how did it detach from that plane part? In what direction do you see the force? If it's a diagonal force, if this plane part has diagonal markings, they say that that could mean that the plane spiraled into the ocean. Also, if the plane part comes out at an angle on one side of it and then another side has a different angle, those would be opposing forces that could give them some evidence.
So these are small matters but could make a big difference to understanding what happened. Okay, well, that was our correspondent here in Washington, Carolyn Persutti. Thanks so much for that.
Anytime, Michael. Thank you.
Now for a look at the entertainment world. Last Thursday evening, while Republicans were holding their first presidential debate on television, this country's founding fathers were holding their own debates on Broadway with the opening of Hamilton, a new hip-hop musical by and starring Lin-Manuel Miranda. As Jeff London reports, the buzz has been growing for the show about Alexander Hamilton, the man on the U.S. $10 bill, since the show opened last winter in New York.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has been working on Hamilton for 6 years. It started with him sitting on a beach, reading Ron Chernow's 832-page biography of the country's first Treasury Secretary, and realizing the story sang to him.
I feel like a mosquito that hit an artery. That's how I felt when I read Ron Chernow's book. I just thought, Hamilton's life story contains multitudes, particularly in the way Ron unlocked it, in the way that Hamilton is sort of the proto-American immigrant story, the trauma of his early years, and how that kind of created a crack in the foundation.
Biographer Chernow says he was initially skeptical that his book could be turned into a musical, much less one that uses rap as its main source of expression. But he agreed to meet with Miranda.
He came over to my house. He sat on my living room couch. He started snapping his fingers, and he sang the opening song. And I absolutely marveled at what he'd done because I realized that he had condensed the first 40 pages of my book accurately into a 4.5-minute song.
Miranda performed that opening number at a poetry evening at the White House in 2009.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of the trade and charter.
Hamilton's life really was like a Dickensian novel, filled with coincidence and reversals of fortune. He brought himself out of poverty, immigrated to New York, and became a leading figure in the American Revolution as an aide to George Washington. He wrote most of the Federalist Papers, created the National Bank, was involved in the first national sex scandal, and managed to create enemies, from Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to Aaron Burr, who famously killed Hamilton in a duel.
The fights we had then in the formation of our country will be the fights we have 100 years from now, 200 years from now. They will be, what is the role of the state versus the role of the larger country? What is our responsibility to other countries that are not our own? The two battles, cabinet battles in our show, are about those two things, because they're going to outlive us. We'll always be having those fights.
In telling this story from over 200 years ago, Miranda and his director, Thomas Kail, made the decision to have the show performed by a multiracial, multi-ethnic cast.
Tommy's goal was to eliminate any distance between a contemporary audience and this story. That's what the music aims to do. That's what the entire production aims to do. And so it's a story of America then told by what America looks like now.
I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
One of the repeated lines in Hamilton is, "Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?" And Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to make sure that this story is told by as many different people as possible once the run on Broadway is done years from now.
When this is done as the school play, it opens up the show to the entire school. And that's something I'm really excited about.
Critics and audiences are already excited. The show received rave reviews on its Broadway opening, and the box office now tops $32 million. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Zahra Abu Zaid. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I am on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And so is the show. You can find us at VOA_IE. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
50 years ago this month, American democracy was born anew with the signing into law of the U.S. Voting Rights Act. Forged in the crucible of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, when black Americans and other minorities organized to end decades of discrimination against them, the law both reaffirmed their basic rights as citizens and revolutionized our political system. The act, signed by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965, affirmed blacks and other minorities' right to vote, a right that came with the fall of slavery a century earlier, but was often denied by political means. It struck down many procedures used in various cities and states to maintain white political control by limiting the votes of minorities. These included requirements that voters pay a tax to cast a ballot and be able to prove that they could read and write. It also provided federal oversight of elections where black voter registration was low, and it empowered the Attorney General to investigate other tactics used to suppress the vote. Almost overnight, black voter registration grew exponentially, most markedly in the South, where discrimination had been most pronounced. Since then, Congress has followed up by adding amendments several times, most notably by requiring bilingual elections, thus enfranchising foreign speakers as well as racial minorities. In the years to follow, our political leadership, from city halls to state houses to the U.S. Capitol and the White House, grew more diverse. By the mid-1990s, these moves and the broadening of the U.S. electorate they fostered had culminated in an almost complete realignment of our two major political parties. As the nation celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the great strides we've taken as a nation since, we also remember those who worked to make the law and its ideals a reality, securing for all the full blessings and privileges of American life.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.